Blog Talk Radio.
Well, I tried to do our intro, and I'm not sure why it's not working.
Here it is.
Friends, to the show that never ends. We're so glad you could attend. Come inside, come inside. There behind the glass stands a real blade of grass. Be careful as you pass. Move along, move along. Come inside, the show's about to start. Guaranteed to blow your head apart. Rest assured, don't get your money's worth. When you do the show, it happens out
of your show. Well, welcome back to my friends, the show that never ends. And it is officially springtime in New York. A beautiful 55 degrees here in New York City. Sean Palmer along with my co-host Seth Kamens. Or I guess I'm the co-host. I don't really know anymore. I guess we're co-co-hosts. And
Aren't we just co-hosts?
There's no lead. There's no co. We're just co-co-hosts. Anyway, we will be having Jared Swirling of the Bleacher Report, our longtime friend and colleague, on at 7:30 to talk NBA, NCAA Final Four, and where the prospects in the NCAA Final Four are going to go and where they fit in best. So if you'd like to call in, 760-283-0846. But today, my friends, opening day in the baseball world. Well, last night really was. And Seth, did you see what kind of crap was coming out of Wrigley Field? And I say that in all earnest, there was a lot of crap.
Yeah, unfortunately, as most of you know, I'm at the end of my other job. I'm working about 85 hours a week, so I haven't been able to see anything, but I have heard that there was a little bit of a bathroom problem at the old ball field.
A little bit. Well, the reports were that the men's bathroom was actually four times longer than the women's bathroom. I can't imagine the last time that ever happened. Four times? I mean, this is in Oakland Coliseum where the shit is actually falling onto the field. But it's pretty close. I mean, I don't know how many of you have been to Wrigley. I made my first pilgrimage there last year. I will be going again in the second week of May to see METS Mets playing there. And hopefully that'll be the first week of the new bleachers. But it's one of those old stadiums, and they have troughs for bathrooms for the men. And I don't know how long it takes most people to go to a trough, but it's if you've been to the Carrier Dome or been to the Wrigley Field, it's kind of the same thing. It's just a trough. I mean, I know when you came to the Carrier Dome, Seth, you were mildly disgusted.
Well, you also have to remember, I wasn't, because I'm the world's biggest slob. So I didn't have much of an opinion on it in regards to it being a kind of a hole in the wall in that regard. But, and God knows, who am I to argue about a good trough? But it was, yeah, this is why the rebuilding of Wrigley, there's not really much you could say. I guess there's a lot you can say. But a bad start as they lose 6-1 or 3-0. Yes, it ended up being 3-0. Excuse me, to Adam Wainwright and the Cardinals, and a just bad start in general to the Joe Maddon era in Wrigleyville.
Yeah, I think you're confusing that 6-1 score with your Skankies today. I mean, losing 6-1 to the Blue Jays. But I gotta give credit to the Yankee faithful, who did applaud and give an ovation to A-Rod. Now, we've discussed A-Rod ad nauseum on the show, but he deserves applause today. And I know many of the faithful are going to say, wait a second, you've pretty much lambasted this guy for the last 2 to 3 years. Well, you're right, I have. But I took a second look at that today, and I said, is he any different? And Seth, I ask you this question as well. Is he any different than hundreds and hundreds of Major League Baseball players over the last 10 years? Or is he just, like Mark McGwire was with Andro, is he just the face of the steroid era for the last 10 years?
I don't think he is the face of it. I think Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens are probably the face of the steroid era. I think the difference is certain people, whether they're caught with PEDs or not, have earned, you know, because of fan reaction, have received the benefit of the doubt. You know, and a good example would be someone like an Andy Pettit, who is still a borderline Hall of Fame candidate despite admitted to PED use. The problem with A-Rod has been everything that's come along with him, from, you know, I remember from the re-signing, you know, announcing during the Red Sox World Series that he was opting to a free agent, to, you know, running from third to first, you know, directly to kind of screw up a pop-up, and like all these, you know, to trying to take the glove off of the Red Sox, was it Varitek or I forget who it was. All of these little things have eroded a man who was beloved when he started his career in Seattle. And, you know, I'm not going to say he has suffered, because I don't think that's quite the right word, but he sat out a season. He didn't kill anybody. You know, there comes a point where you have to say, okay, this is what's been determined. Let's move on. And I think that's what Yankee fans did. You know, he's paid in a lot of ways. He's paid enough. Let him finish his career, and let's see where he goes from here.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, this goes right back to the Pete Rose argument with me, in that he has paid his price. The penance has been paid. The thing about A-Rod, and I agree with you that you would put Bonds and Clemens in that category, but they're not playing anymore. So they've been out of the public eye for over 5 years, in Bonds' case and Clemens. So the case is, at this point, baseball is still trying to recover from what was its steroid era. I still think they're in recovery. And here you have a lightning rod of A-Rod. And it wasn't meant as a pun, but seriously, it is.
That sounds like something that John Sterling would say.
Yeah.
A lightning rod. A lightning rod. It is a pop up to second base, because half the time, I could do a whole podcast on that. But anyway.
But I think that's where it all comes down to for me, is that he is still that lightning rod that is available to be tortured for baseball fans, where they see, okay, he's still a guy that we can heckle. He's still a guy that he hasn't admitted to it in full blown. He said that, yes, maybe he skirted the details a lot, but he's never come outright. And I was saying this to a buddy at work today. Human beings are very forgiving people by nature. We are, because if not, we wouldn't have prison. We just kill them. So we forgive.
Oh, and to be fair, if I was not the world's most forgiving person, I would have shot you years ago.
Thanks. I appreciate that. But anyway. Okay. We all say this in jest, ladies and gentlemen. You should not be calling the police for a threat here. But anyway. But we are a forgiving people. We are a forgiving society. And here you have A-Rod, who has never really asked for forgiveness. Like, you have your McGwire, who came out and said, look, I did it. You have even Pete Rose, who has said, you know, I did it. And I'll tell you, if Pete Rose did not say that, it's like 10 years now, people would still not, the clamor would not be for Pete Rose to be in the Hall of Fame.
Do you think there's a significant clamor for Pete Rose to be in the Hall of Fame?
Yes. I think there is a clamor for him to be in the Hall of Fame. I don't think there is a clamor for him to be in baseball. And I think there is a difference. I think the fans are saying, you know what, enough is enough. Let's not let him back to manage. Not that he's going to manage anyway. I mean, he's over 70 years old. Let's not let him back in the game where he can influence people. I mean, this is a take by Buster Olney, and I agree with it, in that can't we allow him in a limited form? Can't we allow him in so he makes public appearances on behalf of Major League Baseball? He is beloved in Ohio. Beloved. He's probably the most popular player ever from the state of Ohio in any sport. So with the All-Star game going back to Cincinnati this year, you know what? Maybe it's time. I mean, look, I never really thought he should have been banned to begin with. But that's just my take on it. But maybe it's time. You know, it's funny, Seth, just to switch gears for a little bit. Lon Simmons, Hall of Famer from the Giants, the broadcaster, Lon Simmons, passed away yesterday. Some of us remember him with Al Michaels in the 80s. He did broadcast the radio broadcast of the Earthquake game. And I've talked to many San Francisco Giant fans, San Francisco 49er fans, that grew up with Lon Simmons. They absolutely grew up. Who are the announcers? And we just talked about John Sterling, and I would say John Sterling is one of those guys that I enjoy listening to. I mean, I think he's the biggest homer that there is. But there are lots of people that grew up with John Sterling. Who are the broadcasters that you grew up with?
Marv Albert. Vin Scully. Although he was a Dodger. But Marv Albert was first and foremost because I was a basketball kid growing up.
Right.
Baseball, it was Phil Rizzuto, who was a homer, but kind of in a different way than a John Sterling. The NFL was Pat Summerall and John Madden. And I didn't grow up as a big hockey fan, so as good as Emmerich is, I didn't grow up with him.
Sure.
So those would be the first names that would come to my mind.
See, I find it interesting that you said Summerall and Madden, because it proves once again how much of a national sport football is, and maybe the other sports are a little bit more regional. Now, you didn't grow up with Marv Albert on TNT. Right.
No, I grew up with him doing the Knicks.
Right. On what was WFA. I believe they were on 660 WNBC at the time, and then moved over to 1050, and he was on, it wasn't MSG. I don't remember what channel they were on at the time. I know Marv did do some national broadcasts, and he definitely did Lakers Celtics a number of times, but what channel was he on when you were watching him? Because I didn't have cable growing up, so I can't say that I watched any Knicks.
I thought it was MSG. But it could have been It could have been WOR, Channel 9. I honestly don't remember.
Sure.
I was the world's biggest Knicks fan. And as you said, football is different. Football is a national game as opposed to baseball being more of a regional, where, you know, in the NBA is the same way, but that's also the way, you know, John Madden or Madden and Summerall did 90% of the Giants games.
Sure.
So even knowing it was a national game, unless it was Cowboys Redskins, they were probably doing the Giants game. So I saw them more as a regional than I did as a national.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the guys that I grew up with, and like I said before, I did not have cable growing up, so it was very infrequent for me to actually watch a game. I was more a radio guy. On the radio, it was always Jig McDonald and Eddie Westfall, and Gary Landers for the Islanders. The Mets was Gary Cohen and Bob Murphy. Ralph Kiner occasionally, Lindsey Nelson very early on in like the early 80s.
You remember Lindsey Nelson?
I remember Lindsey Nelson coming back when he would do like guest appearances. Not necessarily that he was on, but guest appearances. And I remember Kiner's Corner. Every Met fan remembers Kiner's Corner. And you're right, for Yankee games it was always Scooter, right? I mean, The thing that I liked more about Scooter, the thing that I can differentiate between Scooter and Jigs, Scooter and John Sterling, is Scooter was much the same as Eddie Westfall. He had played for the team. If you play for that team, you probably have the right to be a homer, as opposed to John Sterling, who just comes across as fake, at least to me. I don't know about to you. And then you have the Jets, yeah. and I believe it or not, the Jets was actually an ex-Giant. It was Dave Jennings.
Yep.
The late Dave Jennings. He did all the games, and I think it was Don Crickey did the games as well on the radio. And I basically listened to the radio all throughout college because I went in New York. So you had radio up until, I mean, Syracuse had New York radio. So those are the guys that I grew up with. Those are the guys that Seth grew up with. If you have guys that you grew up with, give us a call, 760-283-0846. We'd love to hear from you and where you go with this. It's very strange to go back and look at who we once grew up with, and unfortunately seeing these broadcasters and even seeing these heroes of ours. I mean, I loved Bob Murphy. I loved Ralph Kiner. I mean, these are my guys. And they've started passing away, and that's unfortunate, but that's life. So that's where I'm going with that. I don't really have any more to say about that. More than it's always interesting to see, like tonight we have Grant Hill on, segueing over to the national championship, Grant Hill and Billy Packer. And Billy Packer always, to me, was always the NCAA tournament.
Well, speaking of the NCAA tournament, somebody picked the final correctly.
Wait, are we talking about the NCAA? That was on Wisconsin by the Wisconsin Marching Band, University of Wisconsin Marching Band. I give you credit, my friend. I don't even have to look up the scores. You have won this year's Battle of the Tournaments.
I am actually in the 96th and 97th percentile on ESPN.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm just looking.
I should probably go look at that. I got to tell you, congratulations on getting to my level. But I just do it in the drafts.
Yeah, it was the first year in 20 to 25 that I haven't done a legitimate pool other than this one, and it's a shame. I mean, I wouldn't have won anything because I got destroyed. The Virginia Michigan State game pretty much single handedly ruined my fate. But did get all the other three teams, and I do have Wisconsin over Duke in the final. So, a pretty solid showing for me for a change in the big dance.
Well, Seth, I surrender. You have won. I am 36.1%. I'm awful when it came to picking this tournament. But I will tell you right now, revenge is near, my friend. 24 days until the NFL draft. 24 days. So that Monday, I will lay claim to victory in picking the NFL draft once again. Because
that is most likely true. I always seem to go for upsets, and that's one of our more fun shows of the year. Although I'm realizing we may have to record on a different day. I will be flying back from Puerto Rico. I don't know if I'll be home in time.
I feel for you. You'll be in Puerto Rico.
Yeah. Well,
ladies and gentlemen, the man does deserve a little bit of leeway. He is getting married soon.
That is, so if I don't kill my fiance or she doesn't kill me first, yes, in about 3 months or so.
I will be, oh, I'll still be Mr. Caymans, but yeah,
Mr. Fink.
Or I'll be Mr. Fink. Jeez. But yeah, we're going down to Puerto Rico. As some of you know, I am getting married there June 28th. So we're finishing, you know, after my busy season is over, I will be finalizing some, we're going to be finalizing some last little details down there. I will be sitting on a beach, probably sleeping for about 36 straight hours after working 80 consecutive days. A busy season, so I am a bit burned out right now. But
but you'll look forward to that Monday, the 28th, will be, I'm sorry, it's the 29th. We will be having a show live from the beach in Puerto Rico. So
that is true.
Stay tuned to that. I believe that is right after the NBA draft. So that will be our wrap up of the NBA draft.
And that will be fun. We'll have guest stars left and right. I'm sure Mr. Nabate Isles will be chiming in from time to time, offering his opinion. It should be a good old time. And I am, you know, joking aside, I am looking forward. It should be a fun vacation down in Puerto Rico. But now the question is, and this drove me insane because as our Jewish brethren know, Passover was on Friday and Saturday night, and I had to go to two seders, one that had basketball on, one that did not. And unfortunately, I had to spend 2.5 hours at the one that did not. Did you get to see the entire Wisconsin-Kentucky game?
I did see the entire Wisconsin-Kentucky game. I did not see the first game, but I don't believe I missed much.
I don't believe you did either. Michigan State just could not defend Mr. Okafor. And out of what I saw, again, I saw little bits of it, and then I had to go running to West Orange for my second Passover. And since it was an Orthodox Seder, not only could I not watch television, I couldn't have my phone on.
Wow.
So I was unable to check the messages. And when it was completed, I ran out, put on the radio, and listened to the last 10 minutes, got home with 20 seconds to go. And my father had the garage door open and the bedroom door open saying, TV's on, go. So I ran up and watched the last 30 seconds. The whole last 30 seconds. So props to my buddies out, friend of mine, Jordan Fivelson, flew out today to Indianapolis, flying back tonight or tomorrow morning from Indianapolis, a proud Badger. Marissa Paul, one of my all-time faves, grad school friend, diehard Dukie. It should be good tonight. Really looking forward to this game. Two very good teams in a legitimate championship game.
See, the thing is, though, I'm not sure how good tonight's going to be. I mean, Wisconsin looked like they were able to do just about anything. And Wisconsin did not have the better talent on that floor.
No.
We've said this all year, right? Kentucky has the most talent of any team in the NCAA, by far. It's not even
I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure they're more talented than Duke in their first. They're deeper. Their talent goes deeper than Duke's does. I'm not sure they're more talented than Duke. Duke is extremely talented. Between Winslow, who's becoming a top three to top five, Okafor, Quinn Cook, the Tyus Jones, is a very talented top five or six. Or top six or seven. Then after that, it drops. You know, Kentucky goes 10 deep. That being the difference.
Yeah, and they don't even have Poitras. I mean, they are as deep as you go and as talented a team as there is. Again, if you want to call in, 760-283-0846, 760-283-0846. And by the way, Seth, this show is scheduled for 2 hours. Don't think we're going to go 2 hours, but it is scheduled for 2 hours. But in any
way, why is this show scheduled for 2 hours? I have 2 hours?
Why is
Derek want to know.
Not spelled correctly? I don't know. We apologize. We apologize to Jared in advance for his name not being spelled correctly. We did tweet out his name correctly in our advertisement. But anyway, see, I don't see tonight. I mean, look, it seemed like nobody, and I mean nobody, could stop Decker. Nobody. When he was on the floor, Wisconsin was basically unstoppable. And unless Winslow is going to do, and Winslow can, but
yes, he can.
He's giving up 3 to 4 inches on Decker. I didn't realize Decker was like 6'9", 6'10". I mean, he's a tall guy. I mean, it seems like the offense runs through Decker, and when he came off the court, and I know you didn't see the game. I'm sure you've seen some highlights and whatnot. When he came off the court, it seemed like Wisconsin's offense stalled, incredibly stalled. So if he gets into foul trouble, I see this being a Duke game. But and again, I predicted 36% of the games right. So who am I to be speaking?
I think the teams are pretty even. I think you have obviously player of the year candidates on both sides. Decker has played himself from, you know, this is a guy who was pretty much the MVP at LeBron James camps. And Wisconsin has been waiting for this for years. I think they're deeper, and I think just eventually they gradually take over. And when, you know, I like the score I said around 78, 72 was what I had put in my final, and I'm not really, you know, maybe a little bit lower, but kind of in that ballpark. The question is this. If Duke wins, we feel like we're saying this every year. Is Krzyzewski the greatest coach of all time? Or is Gino Auriemma the greatest coach of all time? He goes for his 10th title. Against Notre Dame. I mean, Krzyzewski in a much, much, much tougher era than John Wooden. I think the two names you put there are Wooden and Krzyzewski at this point. And Krzyzewski's era is just so much more difficult. Or does whether he win the championship or not matter in that regard?
But is it more difficult? And I say this, I'm not being counterintuitive here, and I'm not trying to play devil's advocate. But back in the 70s, you had to stay 3 years, right? You couldn't play as a freshman, but you had to stay all 3 years at 100%. There was no leaving early unless you went straight out of high school like Spencer Haywood, who, congratulations, made the Hall of Fame yesterday or Saturday. So you had much more mature teams, much bigger teams, and you had a lot more continuity back then than you do today with any of these teams. Wisconsin is the anomaly of the teams, not the norm. I mean, they have, I think it's 4 seniors on their team, 3 in the starting lineup. You don't see that very often anymore. You see that at the Gonzagas. You see that at the Butlers. But you don't see that in the big time.
You see it the high mid-majors.
Right. You don't see that in the Dukes. So could the case be made, and we'll talk to Jared about this because I'm sure he has an opinion on it, but could the case be made that the tournament, not necessarily all of college basketball, but the tournament itself and the better teams in college basketball in the 70s and the late 60s were better 1 through 10 than they are today?
It's a really interesting thought process on this. The question is, the game is, there's a lot more of a rut. In those years, in that era, it was UCLA. Everyone who was a great basketball player wanted to go to UCLA. John Wooden had his choice of talent more than anyone else ever has. Here, you know, even at the top tier, you have Duke, you have Kansas, you have North Carolina, you have, you know, two or three other teams where there is a more competitive landscape for the top talent than it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago. Now, the argument that it was that, you know, these guys played 3-4 years together, it was more difficult to make the tournament at that, you know, years ago. You had 32 teams, you had 24 teams, you had one team from the ACC, the ACC, considered one of the three greatest games of all time was the ACC Championship of 1974, Maryland NC State. And Maryland, they went 96 all with no turnovers in regulation. And NC State would win the game 103-100. And Lefty Driesell went to NC State locker room and said, go win the national championship. And they did, beating UCLA. You know, there was a year North Carolina was number two in the country, lost to South Carolina in a one-game playoff like 1917 because they played a very slow-down game and didn't make the tournament. I think making the tournament was more difficult then. I think because of the overwhelming talent that UCLA had, I don't see it. There were years where there was not even a competition. You know, Walton's junior year in 73, you know, Kareem's year, you know, senior year in 69. You know, I mean, Kareem went 92-2. I mean, they lost to Houston one year in a regular season game with Elvin Hayes, and they beat him by 35 in the Final Four. This UCLA team has always just had so much more talent than anyone else. And I don't feel that way about Duke teams. There are teams that have been more talented. They've had great talent on their teams, but their last championship was not a great talent. The team was Shire and Singler. That was not a greatly talented team.
I agree with you, but let's look at who they played too, right? Were they playing? I understand what you're saying. I completely understand what you're saying. I think the concept that I'm going for is where is the parity, right? So at that time, you had better teams, but were you playing better teams too?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
I straight out don't believe. I don't believe the talent was as good 30 years ago, just 40 years ago as it is now. I realize it's comparative to the era.
Right.
But when you have a team, a UCLA that would have 7-8 high school All-Americans, it was just, it's almost my Bill Snyder, you know, Tom Izzo argument. When you have every piece of talent, how much coaching do you have? I mean, look, Bill Walton, these people swear by Wooden, and I'm not trying to denigrate him in any capacity. But when you have every player that you want, when you have a guy who never started a game for 4 years and is a first round pick because he competed against Jabbar every game in practice, it's such a disparity of talent. I mean, you know, look, I say that I think Izzo is the best coach in the country. And I do, because he gets the most out of his talent is probably a better way to put it. But Krzyzewski, I mean, for the last 25 years, that has been the best program in the country by a pretty significant margin. And they've changed half. I mean, this team doesn't play much defense. This team, Krzyzewski's playing zone with, he adapts to his talent as well as anyone. And, you know, I think it's just, it's an interesting argument. Jared should be calling in. You want to reach out to him?
He has not called in yet, but I will try to reach out.
Is he calling in, or are you calling, out to get him?
I wasn't sure which way it was going. He never really got back to me, so I will give him a call right now and see if I can punch him in.
So, and just think, next week we get to listen to Sean sing the Maryland theme song. I believe that was the premise for our bet this year. Of course, he will embarrass me in the NFL draft, as he normally does. But very rarely do I get wins on these things, so I'll take it whenever I can get it. And if people want to call in and talk NBA and talk with Jared, who's been on the show many times, is one of our favorites, having jumped over from ESPN to Bleacher Report about a year and change ago, and has done some pretty amazing things. I will talk a little bit about that, going to Australia to hang out with Dante Exum. You know, he was hanging out with Michael Jordan. He's really kind of, he has become one of the real heavyweights in the basketball writing world. Also, just a little bit else, I mean, probably should give a little bit of a shout out. Just, we're not going to really talk women's basketball because we're just not really going to talk women's basketball. But Connecticut and Notre Dame, for it seems like the 20th straight year in the Final Four, should be a good game. Connecticut destroying Maryland and Notre Dame beating South Carolina by one on a last second miss by their point guard. I don't know the name. You know, when you come up with that argument of the greatest coaches of all time, where Auriemma fits in is an interesting discussion, because I almost kind of wonder if the comparison with Wooden is accurate, because what has been his competition? You know, Pat Summitt was there in the beginning of Tennessee. Over the last 10 years, there really hasn't been much. And they've won, Seth, I want to say, probably 5 or 6 out of those titles. Yes.
Seth, we got Jared on the phone. Let's get his take on this. Jared, we're talking NCAA tournament and which era being John Wooden's era. Seth is making the case that Mike Krzyzewski is maybe the best coach of all time in college basketball. And he's making this point because he feels that he's done more with less against better competition. My response to that, and we'll get Jared's whirling of Bleacher Report's opinion on this in 1 second, is that back when Wooden was playing, the teams themselves were more cohesive and better teams all around. And while the lower teams, the Butlers and the Gonzagas, weren't as good, the Houstons, the Notre Dames, the UCLAs, the USCs, the powerhouses, in my opinion, were much better.
Well, you know, let me just preface by saying I don't cover college basketball, so I don't have a greatest opinion on this. But, you know, I think just being a fan, from a fan's perspective, and just getting a chance to know some of the coaches and players through the years, you know, I think a lot of what goes under report is the recruiting aspects of college coaches. You know, I think what they represent to the institution way beyond the court, I think sometimes – goes very underreported. And I think that when teams build up their foundations with players and through the years, a lot of what's missed is the personalities, the human interaction, the time that coaches have in the households with the players and their families. And, you know, I think guys like Coach K and John Calipari and the guys that have made that legacy, you know, through the years, I think that it really starts in the private world, the world that we don't really get a chance to see. Way behind the scenes. And I think, you know, from the players to the families to the alumni, it's a much more unique and stronger bond than it is on the professional level. You know, so I think, you know, when I think about the greatest coaches, I always think about, you know, how they're treated among, like, you know, father figures. Like, look at Dean Smith, for example. In his will, you know, he left $200 for each player that's played for him. You know, so that's a lot. That's over 120 players or so. So It's great to see that connection with programs and players. And, you know, I think even like when a guy like John Calipari comes out after they lose to Wisconsin and, you know, talks about the strength of the team from a family perspective, that's so unique to me. I think why we gravitate to the college basketball experience or just college sports in general, because it's just there's so much more to it, from the bands to the alumni to the environment and the arenas and all that stuff. So from a fan's perspective and an outsider's perspective, that's what I appreciate the most about coaches and just the environment itself.
Well, Jared, you just mentioned something very interesting. So John Calipari recently elected to the Basketball Hall of Fame this past weekend. Rumors are that he is looking around in the NBA. What are you hearing about that?
Well, you know, I think that it's definitely a possibility. You know, his name has come up even in the past. You know, I know Billy Donovan is itching to get back to the NBA circles as well. You know, you look at a guy like Brad Stevens, for example. You know, the success that he's had in Boston this year, that they could be a playoff team with the roster that they have. It's not the greatest roster. They traded Rajon Rondo and Jeff Green this year, but he's a very underrated coach and, you know, came out of basically nowhere to coach Butler to the Final Four a couple years in a row, and now he's a lot of success in Boston. So I think the young coaching model, I think it's giving some college coaches confidence that they can get into the NBA and be successful. So, you know, even Kevin Olley, for example, from UConn, you know, he was potentially offered an NBA job. So I think for the younger coaches, the guys that have had success in the college level, there's more of a connection now. So guys might be itching to get in. And for a guy like John Calipari, I can see the interest and the intrigue of the NBA. First of all, he'll get paid a lot of money. That's definitely no question there. And the second is, you know, he's done so much in Kentucky. I mean, he's produced like 25 NBA players in like 5-6 years. You know, does he want to keep building on that? He can if he wants to. But is that a challenge anymore? You know, I'm clearly they didn't get to the championship game tonight, so that's a challenge to get back there next year. But he's dominated on the college level. You know, he's dominated so much that they even talk about that Kentucky could beat the Philadelphia 76ers or the New York Knicks this year. So is he ready for the next challenge? He's definitely ready for it. You know, I think his influence goes way beyond the court, like I said, from the recruiting to the connection to the players, dominating the locker room, commanding respect. So I can see him definitely in the NBA if he wants to this summer.
The other names from the college ranks that we've been hearing, Billy Donovan, which would be an obvious fit in Orlando, having turned down the job, I guess, about 7 or 8 years ago, and Fred Hoiberg from Iowa State. Is this kind of, I guess, is just to kind of continue on with where you were going with this? Is it, you know, there was a trend for many years was the assistant coaches that have been, you know, paying their dues, so on and so forth. With this, the moderate success of Stevens, I guess, because as you said, he has very little talent. Boston, is this kind of the beginning of kind of trying to go back into getting into the high profile college coach? You think it's the beginning of trying to restart the college coach realm and going in that direction?
Well, yeah. Well, first of all, I would preface or start off this conversation by saying that I think what goes very underreported is how close NBA and college coaches are. For example, Billy Donovan every August has a coaches clinic at the University of Florida, where guys like Stan Van Gundy, Steve Clifford, other head coaches go to. There are a lot of coaching clinics throughout the summer that happen, even in cities, major cities where there are NBA teams. College coaches come to NBA practices to witness the practices. The same goes for NBA guys to the college levels. You know, so a lot of the NBA coaches played very high level D1 basketball. And the strength of that connection to their universities, it will be there, will always be there. And so, you know, I think that's why the connection is so strong that, there's always going to be that very strong link between the NBA and the college because of just the coaching connection. It's much more than the players. The bond with coaches really is from the college level. Once players get to the NBA, you know, they're living more in an entertainment life, Hollywood life, you know, with actors and musicians and high rollers and private jets, but the coaches still pretty much remain pretty humble. You know, they live in more of a humble life circle, and, you know, they're connected to the lower ranks of basketball, even down to high school. You know, Eric Spoelstra, for example, on his off days, he works with high school coaches. You know, and you don't really hear NBA players doing that during the regular season. They might do a camp during the summer, but it's a lot more limited. And, you know, I think also on the college level, there's a lot more structure with plays, defenses, more technicalities with the coaching. You know, in the NBA, it's more of a fluid game, so there's a little bit less coaching necessarily, but there's a lot of good plays that coaches, NBA coaches pick up on the college level, out-of-bounds plays, half-court sets, things like that. For example, the Princeton offense, it was a college system that's been used in the NBA. So it's not used as much today, but that just gives you an example of the influence that the college ranks has on the NBA. So it'll always be there, and it'll continue to be there, and it's a really fascinating relationship on many levels.
So, if not to put you on the spot, but I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit. Do you think if you had to make a prediction of whether John Calipari and Billy Donovan are in the NBA or back in college next year, and if in the NBA, where will they be?
I think Calipari will do Kentucky. I think the fact that they lost in the Final Four, I think there's a niche there to get back. That's just my take. I think he's... you know, I think, you know, he can definitely do the NBA, like I said, but I think it's still the Kentucky experience he has still feels, you know, I'm sure fresh for him a little bit. And, you know, I think the loss, you know, that's a challenge for him to get back to try to win it. So, you know, just the sense I have, I think he'll want to, you know, find that glory again. But again, it's going to come down to the opportunity, the money, the city, the market. You know, we don't really know who's going to get fired yet. You know, we still got 6 games to go in the regular season. And, you know, there could be 5 vacancies, you know, by the summertime. And Calipari might be really intrigued in a certain market, a certain owner that he knows, or a player that he wants to, you know, coach around. So, you know, there's a lot of variables obviously can happen. But to answer your question, you know, right now, I think he's going to come back. And for Billy Donovan, I think he's probably more likely to leave because he's been at Florida a much longer time. You know, I think, you know, he hasn't had as much success lately. So, but I think, like you said before, is linked to the Orlando Magic. That's a team that needs a head coach this summer, so maybe that's a possibility. They have a nice young roster there with Victor Oladipo and Nikolai Vucevic anchoring your perimeter and your interior, so that's a nice 1-2 punch to build around, not to mention a potential rookie leader candidate in Elfrid Payton. So I think Donovan might be more likely to go to the NBA. But I think for Calipari, I think in some sense he's kind of still getting started. I think he's going to really try to build this historic foundation, and I think losing to Wisconsin, I don't know, gives him maybe a little bit of extra incentive to return. So we'll see.
Sure. One of the surprises that I saw in the media the other day is that Phil Jackson supposedly said, and I saw this on one of the articles, was that the triangle offense, and we'll bring this a little bit more to New York-centric, is the triangle offense is not necessarily where the Knicks are going in the future. Now, for 2 years, all New Yorkers have heard is triangle this, triangle that. We're getting people out of the system because they can't play the triangle. And now it seems like he's blowing it all up. What do you make of that, more of free agency coming, that we want different players, or what do you make of that?
I start the conversation off by saying it was very sensationalized. You know, I live in New York City. There's three major newspapers here: the New York Daily News, the New York Post, and the New York Times. And a lot of what drives viewership and readership here are headline news. You know, the stories themselves, honestly, they're more sellable stories. They gravitate to a certain theme, and they sensationalize it. The triangle got so much sensationalized attention that I think people that cover basketball, really cover basketball, really understood that the triangle would not be utilized every set or every time down the court. It was brought up way too frequently, and it didn't paint a very fair perspective on what the Knicks were going to do this season. It was a sexy headline, but you know, the triangle or any set or any system nowadays is not run in full. You know, years ago, a system would be run pretty much in full. You know, the Princeton or the triangle, for example, but you know, there's a lot more high pick and roll, multiple pick and roll sets. There's a lot more early offense. You know, teams now are scoring, you know, about 5 to 10 seconds off the shot clock, much earlier than the offense. NBA scouts call it early offense. Some people call it secondary fast break. So the game is more sped up. There's more trailing 3-point shots and just quicker offensive sets. So, you know, it's not fair to say the triangle offense is going to be run 99 or 100% of the time. And I've watched the Knicks a lot. I live in New York City. I mean, it's been run, but there's, you know, for stories that I saw a story the other day on like ESPN, it said, like, you know, Derek Fisher is utilizing the pick and roll more. That's not a fair story because the pick and roll is run more throughout the entire NBA, you know? So I think that for writers, they have to be just realistic with fans and bring in the right basketball knowledge. You know, again, it goes back to what headlines are. And I think that, you know, the NBA is, like I said, it's faster. There's more pick and rolls. You know, two more teams are running with the Spurs run, the strong and weak action with misdirectional stuff. So the triangle will be used, but I agree with Phil. I mean, it's not going to be used all the time. So I think we have to be fair with the audience and let them know what the real deal is.
One of the things I also want to talk about quickly is, and this has been discussed, and it seems like such a reactive thing as opposed to a proactive, is getting rid of the 8 teams in each conference and just having the best 16 make the playoffs. You look at the West, extraordinarily strong. You have 7 teams, 6 teams that already have 50 wins. And in the East, you have, realistically, you have Atlanta, Cleveland, Chicago on a good day, and, you know, Toronto and Washington are, you know, you know, this has been spoken about quite a bit, but I get the feeling it's more hyperbole than anything else. Is there a realistic view that the NBA would get, almost for all intents and purposes, render the conferences meaningless and go to a 1-16, just 1-16 best of, as opposed to just staying in the 8 team in each conference best of to make the playoffs?
No, it's a really great question, and I could see the intrigue with it, and especially a year like this year, where, you know, the eighth seed in the Western Conference would basically be like the second seed or third seed in the Eastern Conference. So, but again, you know, 5 years from now, you know, this will be more balanced in the NBA. You know, there's some nice young talent in the East, and it's, you never know what's going to happen. You know, the balance of power could shift a little bit, and you know, I think what's made the Western Conference so great is the big men, you know, from LaMarcus Aldridge to Dirk Nowitzki to Tim Duncan to Blake Griffin. You know, these are great anchors for any team to have a down low presence in a stretch four. And those guys aren't really so much in the Eastern Conference. They're more out West, and they're great to build teams around. So I think it's a great question. I mean, I could see it feasibly happening from a competitive level, but I also see that the balance will change, and there will be more balance, I think, in both conferences. You know, the NBA is a draft.
It's cyclical.
Yeah, so it's cyclical. But I also, one thing that's, I think, not really mentioned a lot in this conversation is the local TV deals and the businesses that happen in these local markets. You know, the NBA, the business is, you know, has never been better. You know, internationally, it's also really strong, too. And, you know, the NBA is built on individual stars more so than teams. So if you have a team like the Washington Wizards, for example, with John Wall, or, you know, a team like the Miami Heat with Dwayne Wade, you know, they might not be a higher-ranked team, but they still have very good star players that drive a lot of TV audience, a lot of local business. And so I think for owners, they would not be down with that, because you're talking about now a huge dent in that local market, the local business. So, and also the playoffs are about rivalries, you know, still based on conferences and things like that. So I can't see it from a business standpoint. Honestly, I could see the NBA making the biggest change I could see in the NBA in the short term is reducing the back-to-back games to help alleviate some of the injuries. But I don't see a shortening of the season right now. That can come up in the 2017 CBA negotiations potentially, but I don't see the season being shortened, at least for now, or what you just mentioned, the top 16 team. I don't see that happening just yet, but we'll see. I mean, you know, Adam Silver is a commissioner of change, and he's listening to a lot of people right now, and he's, you know, he's a good voice of reason.
Yeah, talking about the differences between commissioners. So we had David Stern up until last year, and then Adam Silver comes in mid last season. What do you see as the biggest differences between the two of them?
Well, I think you know, one thing that's interesting about Adam Silver is that a lot of his work never really got reported on, because David Stern was the face of the league. And I'll give you one example. You know, the reason why the Las Vegas Summer League is in Las Vegas and really had a unique presence in all of pro sports in a city that has gambling, official gambling, was Adam Silver. Adam Silver saw a growing city, a booming city with a lot of entertainment and entertainment vehicles, and worked with Warren Legere. Warren Legere is an agent for many NBA coaches, and they worked together to develop that. So, also, Adam's been huge with international expansion, you know, helping grow the global games and things like that. And, you know, he's also developed very good relationships for many years with owners and players. And he's a big, big student of the game. You know, he's not just a business guy. He really knows the game. So for many years, he was doing a lot of influential work that wasn't really talked about, because David was always the guy in front of the podium on the microphone doing the press conferences. But Adam's been huge, even before up to this point. And I think, you know, looking ahead, I think that he's a very good listener. You know, I think he's really doing his research. You know, he went to the Sloan Analytics Conference this year in Boston to meet analytics people and researchers. And, you know, he's all about absorbing information right now. He's not making any rush decisions. I think the most rush decision he made that was very good was, you know, banning Donald Sterling out of the NBA. I mean, that was a very good, great decision he made. But I think for the future of the league, you know, he's taking his time and he's evaluating different things. But I think he's on to something. I think, you know, even in the sports betting world, I'm sure you've been reading, and I have a story coming out about this topic later this week or next week. But Adam's been the only commissioner in pro sports, or at least in the American pro sports, to come out and support the legalization of gambling. Sports betting. So that's Adam for you. You know, he's taking a great stance. He's a leader in many ways, and I think he's done a fantastic job.
Well, Jared, we appreciate the time. I want to end it on two quick questions. Number one, how was having Dwight Howard's snake hanging around your neck?
I assume you saw the Instagram, right?
I did.
Yeah, or on Facebook. Well, you know, it's funny you say that. I have a story coming out about him next week, and I have a lot of interesting details about that. But, yeah, it was awesome. I mean, Dwight and I hung out, you know, for a good 6-7 hours. We had dinner together. He drove me around Houston in his brand new Mercedes Benz, and he took me to his house. We hung out at his house. He showed me his snakes, and you know, I think what fans are going to learn about Dwight, I think one thing is just maybe kind of how misperceived he is. I mean, I think people see him smiling and having a good time and leaving Orlando, which he did admit to. You know, we talked about the mistakes that he's made. But I think with the guy is like off the court and just, you know, I saw him speak to a school for about like an hour and a half. And, you know, he basically could be like a substitute teacher. You know, he's very funny and engaging. And so, yeah, I mean, he's definitely also a very intellectual guy. You know, he's traveled the world. You know, he can break down like from politics to, you know, different types of animal species to, you know, books. And yeah, he's just a very well-read, well-traveled guy and very smart and funny. And but yeah, the snake thing was crazy. You know, he's got a couple of pythons and boas, and I'm not going to lie, I've never done that before. I had a snake. It started like constricting me. I was with the boa, and it was like, you know, go around my neck. And for a second, it was like kind of squeezing my neck. And the guy that was helping me put the snake around my neck, was like, you know, don't worry, it'll be fine. He's just trying to feel you out. I'm like, you sure? And next thing you know, like just chilled there. He didn't even do anything. He just wrapped around my waist, and then the snake was around my neck, and he just sat there for like 10 minutes, not even doing anything. So I was like, oh, okay, not too bad. But anyway, the story comes out next week, sort of revealing to fans like who the real Dwight Howard is, and I got a chance to really find out some really cool stuff. So that comes out next week. So,
all right. Jared, thanks for taking the time to join us. Hopefully, we'll get to talk again a little bit during the playoffs and talk a little bit more basketball, a little bit more NBA. But thanks for the time. We appreciate it.
No, man. Thank you. No, great question, man. Thanks, guys.
Have a good day.
Okay.
So that was Jared Swirling of the Bleacher Report, and we will link on our Facebook to his site and some of his columns, especially the Dwight Howard piece that will be coming out. Man, you got to look at that boa. That was pretty big. I mean, I had a boa around me. I had a python around my neck once, and when I was, I think I was 14. And man, it didn't constrict around my neck. It just laid on my neck. I'm not sure I'd be gutsy enough to put something around my neck that would constrict. But hey, more power to it. I guess if you hang out with Dwight Howard, you got to be a little open to these things.
I didn't get a chance to touch on it because we took up enough of his time in regards to, he wrote an article for Bleacher Report about the return of Michael Jordan. And I think he got to hang out with Michael for a few hours. And next time we're on the show, he's on the show. And for those of you who have listened for years, Jared's been very good to us and it comes on a couple times a year. You know, I'll ask him about that. And you know, almost from a fan, very rarely do we ask things from a fan perspective. But Jordan, you know, is such a private individual in so many capacities, unless you're Ahmad Rashad, that it would be very interesting to see how that would have gone. I'm just, he would be such a fascinating interview in so many capacities.
How his airness lives. That's basically the way it goes. How his airness lives. And they brought back the original sneakers, I believe, this year. I think it's the 30th anniversary of Michael Jordan's sneakers. Steph, we're old. It just comes down to that. We're old. But I remember when his sneakers first came out, I think they were like I think they were the first sneaker that broke $100. And you look at it today, and you're kind of like, well, $100? You could find, 30 sneakers over $100, if not more than that. But first sneaker that broke $100, I can say with all certainty, I never owned a pair of Air Jordans.
Well, neither did I, because I always rooted. I never rooted for them, so never rooted for them, so it never made much sense to buy them.
I had the Matt Johnsons. I had the purple and gold.
Purple and yellow. Ooh,
I don't
even remember what I had. I don't think I ever bought sneakers based on athletes.
Okay.
I had like the old school Stan Smith tennis shoes, but since he was an Australian from like the 1970s, I'm pretty sure that doesn't count.
Well, that just means you're old, and you were old then. Well, you're old now.
I am old. It is unfortunate.
So to wrap up, next week, we don't really have a lot of time, but next week I will learn the Maryland fight song. I promise that I will pay up my debt. I will learn the Maryland fight song so you can tune in. We'll say that at the middle of the show, 7:30. So if you're tuning in late, Sean Palmer will be singing the Maryland fight song. I know how to spell Maryland. I just got to figure out the rest of it. But
that's
I will.
Okay. I don't know it either, so I can't wait to learn the words.
So for Seth Kamens, this has been Sean Palmer. Thanks very much to Jared Swirling for calling in. Bleacher Report, NBA Basketball, we will be happy to link to some of his articles on our Facebook and Twitter. And next week, next week's wide open. So if you have any suggestions on what we should talk about, please give us a holler on Twitter or on Facebook. And we'll try and get a guest or two.
Sounds good to me.
That's about it. So for Seth Kamens, have a great week. A happy Passover to all that are continuing to, I don't know if it's a celebration, but eating bad food. So we'll talk to you soon, everybody.
Have a good week, everyone. Talk to you next week. Go Badgers.